Welcome to Sabbath School. We're glad that at least some of you remember that we still have Sabbath School class here. Let's have a word of prayer and we'll begin. Our loving Father, we come once again seeking your presence, asking the Holy Spirit to guide us, because these lessons are far beyond our ability. The scriptures is far beyond our ability to comprehend. Help us to understand why you did what you did, and to understand the foibles of human beings as they did what they did in Old Testament times. Now as we turn to Ahab and Jezebel, help us to see what is there for us, is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Ahab and Jezebel. As we know, at this point in history, these people have become almost synonymous with evil. You want to do something wrong, particularly Jezebel, I mean, she is just about it. The story, as you know, is in 1 Kings 16:28 through 18:46, and there are other parts further along in 1 Kings and some into 2 Kings, as we will see. But we need to understand the story a little more. We need to ask ourselves a little investigation into the background of these characters. What do we know, since in some ways Jezebel is the star of the show, what do we know about her background? Jezebel was the daughter of a high priest of Baal, who also, it turns out, by killing his brother, was the king of Tyre and Sidon. So he knocked his brother off so he could be king. He's also high priest. So his daughter ends up marrying Ahab. Now, one of the questions I wonder, and I don't have an answer for it, but maybe you can help me, was this a Solomon kind of an arrangement? Do you remember Solomon who married so many princesses from other countries to sort of cement his relationship with those countries? Or was this a Samson kind of an arrangement, where Samson seemed to be able to see attractiveness only in foreign women? Or some of both? We don't know. We just don't have that kind of information. There's a pretty good chance it was some of both. Ahab recognized that he had some powerful neighbors, particularly Syria to his northeast, and in Damascus, Ben-Hadad. And he figured that if he had good alliances with neighbors to the west and to the south, he would have a better chance of fighting Ben-Hadad in case it came to that, and we'll talk a little bit more as that goes along. Now, Ahab had an interesting background as well, trying to understand these things. Look at number 5 in your handout. We know the story of Solomon, who rose to such incredible power and had all that wisdom and so forth, and then, because of his foolishness, ended up dividing the country. When his son Rehoboam became king, there was a rebellion, and Jeroboam became king of the northern kingdom of Israel, and the two nations were split from that time onward. After some years, Baasha killed Jeroboam's son Nadab and all their relatives, apparently at God's direction, or maybe at God's direction, we're not quite sure. When Baasha's son became king, and on one occasion he drank too heavily at a friend's house and was in turn killed by Zimri, who ruled for the sum total of 7 days. When news got to the general of the army, a gentleman by the name of Omri, that Zimri had taken over the palace, he rushed home because he figured, well, hey, I'm in charge of the army. I can outfox that guy. And he got home and surrounded the city, besieged it, and very quickly took it over, because Zimri had almost no power. So Zimri went inside the palace, locked the doors, set it on fire, and committed suicide. So we have a really, really good tradition going here. Omri, the general, sets himself up as the next king, and Ahab ends up as the son of Omri. And with Omri's 12-year reign and Ahab's some 20-some year reign, they were fairly major contributors to the history of Israel. And if you look at the extra biblical literature that's available, Omri and Ahab are mentioned fairly often. remarkably often in, I mean, names on steles, or, you know, these rocks that are carved and written on and that kind of stuff, and in the ancient literature and so forth. So these two, father and son, made quite a name for themselves in a relatively short period of time. They lived at a time when Israel was in pretty bad shape. And, you know, if you go back to 2 Kings and you look at the, you know, how those king lists go through kings, you know, it talks about the kings of Judah for a moment, and then it talks about the kings of Israel, and then it talks about the kings of Judah. But if you follow just the kings of Israel down through there and you skip over the ones from Judah, you find out that each one basically outdid his predecessors in sinning. And there's no, Jeroboam II was a little better, but really was just about as bad. And so it's just one continuous downward trend until finally the northern kingdom was conquered by Assyria and scattered, and we hear no more about them. But in order to understand much of what goes on in this story, you need to understand something about Baal and Astarte, or Ashtoreth, Estera, depending on which language you want to translate from, because these gods were used in different cultures in ancient times. Baal was thought to be the god of fertility. He was, you know, and I used to think when I was younger and studied these things that when you talk about fertility cult god, it was all about sex orgies and all that kind of stuff in these groves that were at the top of the hills and so forth. And yes, it was. But you see, what they taught was this, that if you didn't get involved in that kind of stuff, your crops would fail, your herds wouldn't give birth to their young and so forth. And so if you're a subsistence farmer who lives in a place where there's a marginal rainfall at the best, and that's Israel, Palestine, then, you know, if someone says to you, and I grew up in a farming community, my father was a physician, but I grew up in a farming community, and the word spreads like wildfire. If someone says, someone's come out with a new kind of wheat that produces 25% more, you know, harvest from the same amount of grain, I mean, that's wild news among the farmers. Or someone's come out with a new kind of corn and so forth. I don't know how many of you are aware of the Green Revolution, which happened some years ago and is ongoing, started by a gentleman who just received the highest civilian award you can receive from the United States government by starting a program of research to develop better strains of rice, better strains of wheat, better strains of corn, which have now been spread to the third world countries and basically keep them alive. If it were not for the research of this gentleman, there would be millions more out there dying of starvation than there are right now. So you tell a subsistence farmer, particularly, okay, you do this, something you do in whatever kind of thing, and you get 25% more harvest or 50% more harvest, or your cattle or your donkeys or your camels, whatever, will produce more young. That's a pretty irresistible argument. And so they fell for it. Well, Jezebel and her father, Ethbaal, were probably looking to expand their empire. It's hard to know for sure whether she married Ahab for his power, for the opportunity to spread the power of her father over the northern kingdom of Israel, or whether it was the other way around. Ahab married her in order to take advantage of her power, but it was a power-hungry couple, and that's part of the problem. They were determined to do everything they needed to do to control as much property and wealth and everything as they possibly could. Our lesson mentions a verse over in Psalms 95. Maybe we should just look at that for a second. Let's see, get into the right. 95, I believe it's verse 13, but let me just look for a second real quick. Where it talks about no, it's not verse 13. Well, I'm not going to take time to look for it. But over here it talks about a princess from Tyre who clothed herself in...
45:13.
Is it 45? Okay, I missed it. It's 45 instead of... Okay, let's go back there for a second. The princess is in the palace. How beautiful she is. Her gown is made of gold thread. In her colorful gown, she is led to the king and so forth and so forth. I mean, you know, this is the kind of a situation we're talking about. And later on, you know, she's sometimes credited with being the first, the originator of the cosmetic industry, you know, and she was about to die. She painted her eyeshadows and et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, this was the kind of situation, well, that they were accustomed to. Here were these people living in luxury while everyone was around them was poor, basically subsistence farmers. And then the story really opens up. Well, I guess I should mention one or two other things before we really get into the story. Ahab decided that he needed a better palace. He ruled from a couple of cities. One of them was Tirzah, but he wasn't really happy about that. And so he bought a piece of property from a gentleman by the name of Shemer, and it looked like a well-fortified hill, or it could be turned into a well-fortified hill. And he made his palace on top of the hill there and fortified the hill, and then moved his headquarters there, and it came and called it Samaria after Shemer, the person he got it from. And that's where Samaria got its start. And there on that thing, after he'd married Jezebel in that city, they developed a temple to the god Baal and began to set up priests and other things to this fertility cult god. Now, one other thing that maybe we should mention. Back in the days of Samuel, he had started what came to be called schools of the prophets. These were religious instruction places. Well, they were general education places. There were no schools as we know them today, no general education schools, nothing like that run by the government. But Samuel set these schools up. There were several of them in the northern kingdom of Israel that educated the most promising young men, primarily in biblical matters, but also in general things and so forth. And they would attend these schools and go out and basically ended up being the leaders of the country. Well, these schools prospered, I'm sure, although we don't have them mentioned by name as such, in the days of David and Solomon. And then they sort of passed, I mean, we don't hear about them again until the days of Elijah and Elisha. And part of the reason for that, of course, is that when Jezebel took over in Samaria and decided that we're not going to worship Yahweh anymore, we're now going to start worshiping Baal, that immediately set up a huge conflict between the worshipers of Yahweh and the worshipers of Baal. And if you have read the story recently, you remember that there was a gentleman by the name of Obadiah, and not the one that wrote the book of that name later, a long time later, but a gentleman by the name of Obadiah, who was a faithful servant of Yahweh, but somehow or other managed to keep his job as one of the main workers for Ahab and Jezebel. But he was a faithful follower of Yahweh and preserved a number of these people. But Jezebel was out, and she was ruthless. There's no question about this at all. She was ruthless. She was determined to wipe out the worship of Yahweh in this nation of Israel. And so now we hit the two main stories from which we learn about these characters, about Ahab and Jezebel, that we want to spend some more time on. One day, Ahab and Jezebel were probably both, although it may have been just Ahab, we don't know for sure, sitting on their thrones, probably in a comfortable room with nice furniture and so forth, a place where, you know, you had to go through all the protocols and so forth. You had to get permission if you wanted to go see the king, all that kind of stuff. Well, all of a sudden, without permission, without warning, without anything, Elijah, a hairy man with probably a big old bushy beard and really homespun, very coarse garments that he wore, just came busting into the king's presence. And everybody was, you know, just in a state of shock to see this guy. Who gave him permission to come in here? What's he doing here like this? Elijah didn't wait for anybody. He just says, let me tell you, according to the word of Yahweh, there will be no rain until I say so. And he turned around, and before anyone had a chance to recover their composure, he was gone, and I mean gone. They couldn't find him. Well, of course, that's no problem because we have Baal, right? Baal is the one who sends us rain, right? He sends the storms. He sends the rain. We've got things in hand. We're not going to worry about that kooky guy, whoever he was. But there was no rain. And a year went by, and there was no rain. And I wonder, how would you feel about the high priestess, who is also the queen, who says, come and worship my God because my God can send the rain. And there ain't no rain. God's gone on vacation. Well, they accuse him of worse things than that a little bit later. I mean, what do you do? I mean, how do you maintain your credibility? Well, I'm sure she said that things like, well, this kooky guy Elijah made him upset, and Baal's refusing to answer our prayers because Elijah's upset him, and he's not happy, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, she must have had the stories like you wouldn't believe to try to explain why there was no rain. Well, meanwhile, Elijah, as you know, went east beyond the River Jordan to a small brook by the name of Cherith, and there he was watered by the brook and fed by either passing traders going along the routes between Mesopotamia and Egypt, or by ravens. Interestingly enough, the Hebrew word could be either traders or ravens, depending on how you look at it. But anyway, he was fed probably miraculously by God for a period of time until finally even that brook dried up. And Elijah says, okay, God, what am I going to do now? And he heads west. Well, now, if you knew for a fact that the king and all of his army, etc., is searching high and low for you in every country around, where would you go to hide? Well, it's interesting, you know. I don't know if I should mention this. I'm not a golfer, but I enjoy watching golf once in a while. These marvelous guys who can hit those little balls and make them go where they want to go. There's a story told about an amateur golfer who went out and put his golf ball up on the tee there, and there were a lot of ants around. And he tried to ignore the ants, and he would swing like this, and he hit the ground, and the ants went flying here and there, and he swung again and hit another part of the grass, and the ants went flying everywhere. And one ant says to the other, says, what are we going to do to survive this? And the other guy says, we better get on the ball. So it's a little bit like that. That's what Elijah did. He goes straight to the home of Jezebel's father. Walks down the ocean front a little ways to a town called Zarephath. And, as you know, asks for something to eat from a widow. There he is. You know, who would have thought he's hiding right under the nose of Ethbaal, Jezebel's dad? There he is. Nobody found him. I wonder what the people of Zarephath thought about this preacher who's staying with a widow in town. Elijah was never married, as far as we know. And there they are, all of them living in this small little house. There's some possible hint that Elijah lived in an upstairs room. Maybe so. Hope so. But over a period of time, you remember, they survived miraculously on the flour and the oil that was provided by God.
And then finally God said, well, and while he was there, of course, we know that the widow's son fell sick and died. And Elijah took him upstairs and gave him CPR, laid down on him and spoke to God and prayed about him, and he was raised to life. Jesus wasn't the only one who raised people to life. And took him back down to the widow, and the widow says, now I know that you are a prophet of God. But anyway, just to fill in the details of the story, finally God said to Elijah, okay, now it's time to go back home. 3.5 years. And in a place where, at best, the rainfall is 10, 12 inches of rain a year, you got 3.5 years without any rain, and you can imagine what the place looked like. I mean, dry as a bone. I mean, you just have to look out the door here and look up at the hills. You get a pretty good idea. Really dry. And as you remember the story, Elijah, on his way, meets this Obadiah. And he says, is that you? Yeah, it's me. Well, where have you been? Oh, here and there. Well, I want you to do something for me. What do you want me to do? Go and tell Ahab I'm coming to see him. Well, Obadiah is a little worried. He says, now, just a minute. You know, we know that you've been whisked away before and nobody could find you. How do I know if I go tell Ahab, oh, hey, I saw Elijah and he's coming, and suddenly God whisks you away? Ahab's going to kill me for lying to him. Elijah says, don't worry, I'll be there. And he arrives there at Ahab's presence, wherever that was. They had probably agreed on a certain place to meet. And then Ahab sees him and he says, there you are, you troubler of Israel. And what does Elijah say? Not me. You're the troubler of Israel, not me. And he challenges him to this duel, if you will. Gather all the children of Israel. Take them, tell them to come up to Mount Carmel. Few days from now, I will meet you up here. Bring all the prophets of Baal that you want to. Make sure they're there, and we will see who really is God. If you had been there, would you have gone? Would you like to see this duel? What do you think the people expected to see? What do you think? Hand down here. Lorna, she's going to help me.
Well, I wonder if they thought that Elijah was going to be killed, and they wanted to see the excitement, because if he had caused the rain to not come, because they were not particularly believers at that point, then why not let him be killed and let's go see?
I mean, and that's the point, exactly. You got 850 prophets against you, and here's one Elijah. And they have been told for 3.5 years, this is the guy that's caused all the trouble. What are they expecting? They're expecting him to be mincemeat. That's what they're expecting. That they're going to just, Elijah's going to be wiped out. Yeah, did you want to say something? Yeah, it's coming behind you.
Well, I just think it's interesting that if Elijah is the one who's responsible, as they, you know, I mean, he was between him and God, but if they, who don't believe in God, see this one human being being responsible for no rain, you'd think they'd kind of think of him as kind of a god, you know?
Well, I have pretty good reason to suspect that the line they were given from Jezebel is that this guy is not a god, but he upsets Baal. Mm-hmm. And so Baal's not answering our prayers because Elijah's upset him.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just guessing. I think that's probably the line they got. Yes.
But if they killed him, then they'd never get any rain.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. You know, if you believe what Elijah says, then, yeah, you better make sure he promises rain before you start cutting him up, right? Anyway, they all, yes, we got another hand back here.
It would seem to me, as ruthless as Jezebel was, there were probably some left from the schools of the prophets somewhere in that audience that knew full well the possibilities of what may happen. Mm-hmm. And the fact that 850 Baal priests were killed, I don't see Elijah doing that on his own. Now, some may have turned on him, but I think there was somebody in the back rows of that crowd that knew very well or had the faith to believe what was coming.
Okay, well, we're going to spend some time on that in just a moment, so keep that in mind. Anybody else? What do you think? And the question I would like to ask is, since Jezebel is really largely the instigator of this whole thing, why didn't she go to Mount Carmel? Ahab went. All her priests and cronies all went. Where was Jezebel? And what do you think she was thinking back home? Think of the story from Jezebel's perspective. All of her friends, probably all the palace guard, her husband, everybody's gone. Now, it's not a long distance to Mount Carmel, but they're gone maybe for a couple of days. And she looks out every day, no change, you can't see any change of anything, the ground is still dry, the sun's still beating down, no sign of anything anywhere. And she's waiting for her 850 cronies to come back, probably carrying Elijah in pieces. That's what she's expecting, see? And I'm sure she instructed them very clearly about how they were to dispatch him, not to allow him to escape. And all of a sudden, one evening, after the third or fourth day, it starts pouring rain. Now, what is Jezebel thinking? Well, think about it. From Jezebel's perspective, what do you think's happened? We got rid of that troubler, and now Baal is answering our prayers, right? Isn't that what she would want people to believe anyway? Now, how far she believed that herself, we don't know. But that's what she would want people to believe, I'm sure. And a little while later, her husband shows up and she says, "Where's everybody? Let's celebrate." And what does Ahab say? "They're all dead." "They're what?" "They're all dead." And he tells her the whole story. And she just realizes that she has ended up being the bad guy. She has just been, and let's go up there and talk about the story. Let's think about the story up there on the top of the mountain. These 850 people, they get their chance first. And what do you think they're thinking? Here Elijah says, okay, this is the situation. And these people were accustomed to making sacrifices all day long, every day. They had no problem with that. That's how they got most of what they got to eat. They would chop up these sacrifices and then they would take most of the sacrifice home for supper. That's what they did. So they're up there on this mountain, and Elijah says, "Okay, we're gonna find out who's a real God, and this is the way we're gonna do it." So you set everything up, you set up your altar, you do every thing you have to do, and you can do all the incantations you want, and you can do your dances or whatever, but no fire. Uh-oh. There's a problem. Now, I very strongly suspect, that these guys were accustomed to sneaking fire into a sacrifice to make it look like their God had responded. I really strongly suspect that they had done this before. So they thought, well, that makes it a little tougher, but we got this covered. There's 850 of us. I mean, there's only one Elijah, right? So they set about their business. Well, why do you think they didn't succeed in getting that thing to burn? Wally?
My question here is, if God comes down and destroys these individuals, is he taking away their freedom of choice?
Well, you're getting a little bit ahead of the story. I want you to answer another question first. How do you think it was that they didn't manage? There's 850. Isn't there a way that 850 could somehow sneak some fire into that altar? Yeah, Lorna.
I think Elijah did everything in his power to watch them and call them on it when he saw it. And then I think God covered the rest, because Elijah couldn't be on all sides. And was it more than one altar? It seems like it could have been a bunch of altars. And Elijah just could not be everywhere.
Yeah.
He could do the best he could, but, and then
Well, and the other part to that, I mean, I think your point is correct. The other part to that is that, you know, the children of Israel are watching. And since Elijah had specifically said, okay, this is the deal, you know, if Baal answers with fire, okay, we'll worship him. If God answers with fire, we'll worship him. I mean, the people were watching as well. They wanted to see it happen. I mean, this is the best show they'd seen in years. Okay? Bob.
We have to remember this is part of the great controversy. And Jezebel obviously believed in Baal. Mm-hmm. So Satan must have had something to do with the powers that caused certain things to happen, that she believed that Baal could do these things. Mm-hmm. Now, she's done this long enough. God's decided, I'm going to show you. And so he intervenes, and he brings...
Well, stop right there for a second. Do you think that the devil has the power to light a fire?
Yes.
Of course.
We know that.
If God doesn't prevent him, he can start a fire. Yeah, if God doesn't stop him, the devil has the power to start a fire. He could have lit that thing on fire just like that.
Right.
Okay?
So what is that telling us?
Okay, so what does that tell us?
God's involved.
God's involved. And he has to be.
Right.
Not in cheating or doing something that's unfair, but preventing the devil from doing something that's unfair.
Right.
Okay?
So he sent Elijah on purpose to send this message that Baal is not God.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's working this out to convince the people that... Now, she's obviously still thinking that Baal's the God and that he's going to save her and he's going to bring all this rain. So when the rain starts, it's obvious that she would think that Baal did it.
Mm-hmm.
But God is trying to prove that he is in control, not Satan.
Okay. Yes, Jane Ann.
I was going to say that I think it was probably could be assumed that if they normally snuck in fire, that they were definitely trying at this time. And imagine their frustration when this time their best efforts to light their sacrifices did not work.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Gordon? Olga, go ahead.
I was just going in the same lines you were, that it was God's reputation was at stake. Mm-hmm. And it was not only Israel, but the whole universe was watching. And, of course, God was not going to just allow Satan, who had the power like he did at Pharaoh's, when Moses came to Pharaoh. He could have lit up the fire, but God was not going to, because Satan knew that everybody in the heaven was watching, too.
Yeah. I think that's the best evidence, that point right there. Satan obviously could have started that any one of those altars, there may have been more than one, as Lorna suggested. I'm sure he could have set that thing on fire and made it look like it was a miracle. But God says, okay, the line has been laid down. I suggested this. This is what I wanted to happen. We cannot allow fire to come from Satan because, obviously, what's going to happen? The people would immediately assume that who had sent it? Baal. They would say, okay, Baal sent the fire. Gordon.
Do we have reason to think that this has occurred before, that there has been that Baal had claimed to start fires before? I don't remember a story like that.
We know that Yahweh has sent fires on occasion and started them, even back in the wilderness when Moses was leading the children of Israel. He sent fire down and consumed the offering. We know that. Now, I don't know. I'm not aware of details exactly how the people of Baal did it. But, I'm sure that they probably, I mean, these people were masters at illusion. I mean, what do they have to do all day long except deceive people?
I thought this was kind of a unique challenge by Elijah, that there hadn't really been a challenge like that before, but maybe there had been.
Oh, no, I agree. I think it was a unique challenge. But I think that they figured that they were accustomed to doing this. I think normally they didn't have any problem with it. They just burned the stuff. But I think, I suspect that when Elijah laid down this challenge, those people, 850 prophets, said, well, that makes it a little difficult, but we can do it. I don't think they immediately recognized that this was an impossible task. That would be, at least that's the way I look at it. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah, Lorna.
I'm thinking that this would not have changed Jezebel's belief at all. I think the people that saw it, which were probably the men,
that changed their belief, and that's why Jezebel wasn't there. Women didn't do that. They didn't go. The men went. And it probably did, watching that happen. But for her, if it was true of all the gods in all the ancient cultures, they were very temperamental. And they could not send rain because they were mad and you hadn't killed enough cattle or you hadn't killed enough babies or whatever. And they were holding it back. And then when they sent it, it just happened to come at the same time that he prayed, that Elijah prayed. It wasn't really, you know, it wouldn't change her beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah. Sylvia.
Dr. Hart, do those Israelites go around carrying weapons? I mean, obviously these people were just a little bit ticked at Baal and mad to wipe out 850 Baal priests. And how did they kill them? Did they carry weapons with them?
Yeah.
They did.
When you walked along the roads of Palestine in those days, there were lions. Look at the story of David, you know. He talks about killing lions, killing bears. Sure, they carried weapons.
So they just turned on these guys and killed 850 of them.
Hold on.
I mean, this is a battle.
Wait. Let's get the full story here. Let's get the full impact of what's going. Norm, we'll come to your question in just a moment.
It may not be all that different than today. Those guys couldn't get their those prophets couldn't get their igniters to go off. Sounds like some Middle Eastern doctors that couldn't get their igniters to go off.
Yeah, exactly. Don.
Well, that's why I was wondering, why didn't the Baal priests, if they had weapons, why didn't they defend themselves? Why were they all wiped out?
Well, you've got a whole nation against 850. And I'm not sure that the prophets of Baal probably figured, I don't know that they carried weapons, but there were people around with weapons. And not like nobody had any weapons. There were people with weapons. I know that for sure. Well, so these people are cutting themselves and they're dancing around and they're carrying on all day long. And what's the result? Nothing. And I'm sure that Yahweh was directly responsible for that. And finally Elijah says, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he says, okay, now it's my turn. Stand back. He repairs the altar that had presumably been up there at some time in the past, puts the stones back up, puts the wood on, puts the sacrifice on, and it's maybe a mile or mile and a half or something from the top of Mount Carmel down to the Mediterranean. It sticks out on a promontory right out into the Mediterranean Sea. And so he says, you guys run down there and bring me some buckets of water. They ran down and struggled back up the hill with the bucket. Okay, pour it on. Do it again. Pour it on. Do it again. We're not going to let anything here make people think that we've done any, you know, sleight of hand or something like that. We're going to make this very clear. When we reach the place where everyone recognizes this sacrifice cannot burn, then we're ready. Okay? The wood can't burn. It's soaked. The water's pouring down over everything. Nothing here is going to burn. And Elijah kneels down, offers a simple prayer. And I suspect lightning struck out of a clear blue sky. You know, not to distract you, but I don't know if you've ever seen anything like that. My brother and I were very young, upper primary grades. We were traveling across, let's not go into all the story, but it was just at the time when there was a big push to put all kinds of safety devices in cars. They just came out with the windshield, the squirters to wash your windows, and they just come out with seat belts and all that kind of stuff. And we had one of these new cars with all the stuff in because someone had run into us and destroyed our previous car. So that's why we had a new car. So we went to visit my grandfather, who lived in Nevada. Well, you know what the weather's like in Nevada. Perfectly clear days almost all year long, you know. He lived in Fallon, and the Navy went up there, and they still have a naval base up there because they said, we want to pick a place where it's sunshiny 365 days a year. Well, we went to church with my grandfather, and after church was over, we didn't know anybody. We didn't have anybody to talk to, so we went out and sat in the car, and we were playing with the knobs and so forth and with the new car.
So my grandfather comes over with one of his friends, and he's standing beside our car. Well, you remember in the old days, those squirters for your window, they didn't know exactly how to adjust them right, so they put them way out there on the hood, and they squirted them up at an angle like this so that when you're going about 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour, they'd hit the window, you know? But when you're standing still, they go like this, you know? Well, my grandfather was completely bald. And he's standing there beside our car in the appropriate position. You can guess what's happening. My brother pushes the button, and the squirter goes like this, and the whole thing lands right on my grandfather's head, you know? And he gets this startled look on his face, and he wipes off his head, and he says, "And there's not a cloud in the sky." You know, I suspect that that's the way these people felt. You know, you look up there, there's nothing. I mean, this isn't the time for the thunderstorms. There's no clouds for the lightning to come out of. Gazap! And the fire is burning, the sacrifice is consumed, the wood is consumed. I don't know how long this took. The fire, the stones are burned up, and the fire and the water in the trench around the bottom is gone. Now, has God made his point or not? I mean, the argument about he is here, and you know, right over there is the altar for Baal. And the sacrifice is still there, the wood is still there, the stones are still there, the bleeding priests are standing around. I mean, how can you argue with that kind of evidence? Yeah, Larry.
Well, I think the problem was they didn't put water on their altar.
Maybe so. Okay, Gordon.
Maybe God changed the water into gasoline.
Yeah, okay.
Now, what I wanted to say is, how is it fair for God to use a miracle to convince people when he didn't allow Satan to use a miracle to convince people?
That's a good question. What do you think about that? Was that fair? Or did God cheat here? Ryan. Oh, we got Don. Well, two people, hands up here. Go ahead, Brian.
I wonder if God might not have turned Baal's whole altar inflammable so that they were sticking matches in there. It wouldn't have lit them, no matter what they did.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and I'm wondering if it was, if it would have been less powerful for each one of the altar, each one of the Baal officials, if they had gone up in flames, that wouldn't have been as powerful as consuming the entire altar and water of the Lord's sacrifice.
Okay, Don.
I remember you said once, when God acts, and that's when his creator power is challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this was the issue there.
Yeah, exactly. See, the question here, what is the question here? Let's make it clear. What was the issue here? Who's the real God? Will the real God please stand up? What do you do in a situation like that? Do you say, well, maybe the devil could set this altar on fire. Maybe people could be confused. No, that's not what you do. You do what you have to do. I mean, remember that in those days, the idea was the God who can do the most fantastic things, the God who can help us beat our enemies, he's the real God. That was the story. I don't know whose hand was first. Rob, Bob, was she behind you? Go ahead.
Well, someone mentioned a while ago, was God fair because, you know, was there choice allowed in this situation? But if you stop and think, choice had already been diminished and completely smothered by the devil.
Yeah.
And the people had no choice. They only had what now they were being given and you know, fed by the, you know, the Baal supporters.
And let me support your point. The people who are worshippers of Yahweh, the few of them that were left, did their crops get watered? No, they had been through 3.5 years of drought. For what reason? They didn't do anything wrong. So, yes, go ahead.
So they were object lessons. I mean, they were going through the same object lesson. And so when God used a miracle, he was now making choice available. They could still choose to follow Baal if they preferred.
Which
now,
they did.
The real God was made available, and those who could now see that had that power of choice.
Yeah.
Provided.
Bob.
Well, I think it also had something to do with the offering. You know, God is fair. And if God was going to bring down fire for Elijah, and if his offering was a proper offering, then he would do the same thing if that was true of the offering that was offered on the other.
Okay. But let me put it in these kind of words, and maybe this will help. The question here is, who is the real God? If God had allowed the devil to do some kind of trickery, basically, to make it look like Baal had responded, that would be a lie, wouldn't it?
Yes.
It would be a lie. So we're talking about who the real God is here. You want to finish up? Okay, Norm, you were next.
I'd just like to add to what she said before, because I think she's on the right track. These people, God had to do something dramatic just to get freedom back
in
balance.
This was fairly dramatic, yeah.
It was very dramatic, but I don't. But we have to say that it was not an unfair miracle.
No.
Because, and I think that just shows the degradation of the people, that God would have to do something this dramatic to restore freedom.
Yeah, Olga.
Well, I just think that Satan had the opportunity and the freedom to do what he could at that moment, but I don't think he could produce the fire. It's like the story you said that one time when he's challenging God, okay, let's create man, and then God tells him, you go and get your own dirt.
Yeah.
And it's just like in this situation, God has to respond because he's a consuming fire. And it's like when Jesus was in front of the priest that they were asking him questions when he was taken prisoner to be crucified, when they asked him all lots of questions, he didn't answer. But when they say, in the name of God, answer us, he had to respond because he is God.
Dennis.
Well, this is not the first time that we've seen the powers of Satan limited. We have a rather clear description in the story of Job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he's demonstrated his powers before. Okay. Well, okay, Sylvia, we're going to come back to your question right now.
Obviously, Satan can't send fire. Rain? Because he didn't send rain for 3.5 years.
Not if God prevents him. Satan could send rain. Sure, we can seed clouds. We can cause rain. We can do it. Sure, Satan could do it. But not if God says no. That's the point. You see, what we have, this is not a test to see what Satan can do and what God can do. This is a test to say who is the real God. That's what this is about. And so God says, under those circumstances, I'm not going to allow Satan to pretend. I'm not going to allow him to act like he's a God, because he's not.
No.
See, that's what this is about. So now we come to the interesting part. Well, not the interesting part. The challenging part in some people's thinking. Elijah says, grab those guys, all 850 of them. We're going to dispatch them. That sound like the God you love? And was this Elijah's idea or was this God's idea?
The people were ticked. 3.5 years with no water.
Right, exactly.
I'd be furious too, you false fools.
Yeah, okay. Wally.
How come he didn't do the same with Jezebel? Who's the instigator of this?
There's a good question. She wasn't there. Yeah, good point. He probably would have if she had been there. But think about that for a minute. Why didn't he dispatch her when he got to Jezreel?
But God said how she would die.
Yeah, God had already predicted how she would die. Yeah, Sylvia.
It's hard to believe that when he sees all these people kill all those false priests that he gets afraid of one woman. And all of her priests now are dead. It's just hard to believe that he got afraid of her then.
Yeah. Well, there are some explanations of that. Let's talk about that for a moment. But let's say, in addition to the fact that we're testing one God against another really false God, so the real God stands up and does his thing. But why was it necessary for all those 850 false prophets to be killed? What was the real reason it was necessary?
Cleansing.
Cleansing, yeah.
But there's another reason. Yeah, John.
Well, do you think that God told Elijah to say those words to Ahab to begin this whole thing, or did Elijah do it on his own, from his own standpoint, his own...
This is God speaking.
Pardon?
This is God speaking.
It is, but he didn't tell him to say that, I believe. To
say there will be no rain?
I think Elijah arrived at that idea on his own.
No.
That's just my opinion.
I don't think so.
On the other way, on the other side, now that Elijah says, get them all, let none of them go, I think that was his idea also. But just as God helped him and did things in harmony with this idea of there'll be no rain until I say so, I, Elijah, say so, I think he allowed Elijah to collect them all and dispatch them all. I don't think that it was necessarily the best way, but it was the way Elijah wanted it.
Well, that's a possibility. Let me make another suggestion. Another suggestion. If those 850 men had been alive, stayed alive, had gone back to Jezreel, had spread out through the country, what do you think they would have said?
Lie.
They would have spread every lie you could possibly imagine to try to explain what happened. They would have done, I mean, the impact of Elijah's activity and God's activity on the mountain would have been diminished way faster even than it was. They would have been lying about the whole thing. Now, a lot of men who were there, and probably some women and children as well, saw it, and they would say, well, that's not exactly what I remembered, but if the priest comes around and says, well, it was like this and this, and you just didn't see right, you might be inclined to believe them. God says, we can't have that going on. We got to get rid of the influence of all of these false characters. I think they had to be dispatched. Yes?
It seems to me this is another case of God had tried with Israel, as we know from the history of it in the Bible, many times before, and they'd run off the rails, and in this case, they'd had enough rope, they'd more than hung themselves, and he finally said, enough already, I got to try and get you back on track. They had to be eliminated.
Yeah.
To clean the slate.
Yeah. To give God's people at least a fighting chance to survive. Well, you know, Elijah knelt down on top of the mountain. He told it, after starting to pray, he told his assistant, go check, go check, go check, go check 7 times. And the assistant says, yeah, I see a little tiny cloud way out there over the ocean. And Elijah says, that's all we need. We're on our way. Told Ahab, get ready, get in your chariot. We're headed for Jezreel as fast as we can go. And it started pouring so heavily that you couldn't even see where you were going. It was dark, probably as well, getting dark anyway. And Elijah has to lead Ahab's chariot back to Jezreel. Yes.
Do you think the whole crowd was up there as Elijah sent his servant 7 times? And what did that do for their belief in God?
I know. I think they were dispersing at that point in time. Some were still there, I'm sure. I'm sure there were some there, but most of them were probably dispersing by that time. Because it's getting dark. You got to figure out where you're going to stay tonight. Either that or get home. Yeah, there were several other hands. Who else? Go ahead.
Elijah made his own altar.
Well, he put the stones together, yeah.
Is it the same altar or a different altar?
Different altar.
A different one.
Well, it says there, if you look at the Bible, hold on just a second. 1 Kings 18, see, then Elijah said, I'm looking at 1 Kings 18, starting with verse 30. Then Elijah said to the people, come closer to me, and they all gathered around him. He set about repairing the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. He took 12 stones, one for each of the 12 tribes, named after blah, 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 and he puts it back together. Apparently there had been an altar there before.
There had been an altar there then.
Apparently there had been an altar to Yahweh there in the past, and now he's putting it back together.
Oh. Okay, and I had another question. Did they, before going to Jezreel, they had already killed the prophets of Baal. And so, what's his name?
Ahab arrives home empty-handed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's take a moment or two. Well, we know what happened. You know the rest of the story. Let's take a moment or two to talk about the story of Naboth. That's the other main story. We've got about 4 minutes. Remember, Naboth was a gentleman who lived on his hereditary property next to the palace of Ahab. And Ahab looks out there and sees he has this gorgeous vineyard, and he says, I'd like that vineyard for a vegetable garden. And Naboth says, I can't do that. This is my hereditary property. This is where my family has to live for the rest of our lives. This is the only piece of property that belongs to us. And Ahab goes home and pouts. And his wife says, you're a king? And you let that guy say no to you? I mean, what kind of a king are you? And she says, I'll take care of it. And you know the story. She set up a couple of scoundrels to lie about Naboth and had him stoned to death. And he's gone. So she goes home. She says to Ahab, okay, I got rid of Naboth. The vineyard's yours. And what happens? Ahab's out there enjoying his vineyard, walking around, probably getting ready to figure out what vegetables he's going to plant and so forth. And guess who shows up? Elijah. And I wonder if if Ahab says, another 3.5 years of drought? No, I hope not. He says, there you are, my enemy. You know, what do you have in mind this time? And Elijah doesn't waste any time. He just says, the dogs are going to lick up your blood in the same place where they licked up Naboth's blood. And you know what happened? He went off to war. A random arrow. He told the king of Israel, you dress up like a king. They'll think you're me. They'll shoot you. I'll dress up like an ordinary. Well, I'm sure he didn't say that to the king of Israel, to king of Judah. But he says, I'll dress up like an ordinary soldier. So he's out there looking like everybody else. And God, of course, there's no other explanation for this. God directs this arrow to hit Ahab, and not just to hit him between the pieces of his armor, and basically he dies. By the end of the day, he bleeds to death. He dies in his chariot on the way home. They take the chariot, they bury him, take the chariot out by the spring, washing it down there, and there are the dogs lipping up the blood. Fulfilled. Well, you know what happened to Jezebel. Go ahead, Don.
It's been a while since I read this, but didn't the true prophet warn him not to do that? And it was the false prophet that told him to do that.
The whole story is in there, and I gave a reference, but we don't have... I mean, that's a very interesting story. I'd love to spend the whole period on that, but we don't have time.
I mean,
Micaiah.
The true is still trying to protect his enemy.
God's true prophet warned him, said, please don't go there, don't get involved in this. He did it anyway. He had all these false prophets, had another 400 false prophets already, predicting wonderful success. Well, this is what happened with the wonderful success. Yeah. John?
I know we don't have much time, but I wonder if there was another Elijah came later and how he could be called Elijah. He didn't do the same things that Elijah did. What's the connection there? Why do we call John the Baptist Elijah?
Well, because of the prophecy in Malachi 4, but we don't have time to go there right now. Look at that prophecy and you'll see why we call him Elijah. Anyway, there's still two women left that are problems. Well, there were some others, but Jehu was given instructions as a general to wipe out the whole family of Ahab, and he did. Everybody was left. Ahab himself was dead. So he starts wiping out the whole family, even the descendants over in Judah who were descendants of, because remember, Athaliah, their daughter, Ahab and Jezebel's daughter, married the prince of Judah. So now they're trying to extend their influence into the southern kingdom of Judah. And of course, you know, over there, she as soon as her son was wiped out, she was determined to wipe out all the descendants of David. And so she killed everyone she could find. But of course, they kept one baby. And you remember the story of Joash and how he later, 7 years later, was proclaimed king, and they killed her. But Jezebel, you remember, was up there in her palace, and Jehu finally arrives at Jezreel, and he looks up there, and she looks down, all painted up, you know, looking like the devil himself, I'm sure. They didn't have who were all Max Factor and all that kind of stuff in those days. She looks out the window, and Jehu looks up there, and he says, okay, you guys up there that are there to help her, are you on my side or are you on her side? And they threw her out, clash. And Jehu says, okay, let me finish off the job. I'm not going to take any chances with this woman. He drives his chariot back and forth over top of her. Till she's just, you know, black and blue and dead in pieces almost. So he goes into the palace and says, okay, now I'd like to have something to eat. A little while he says, well, you remember that lady? She was queen for a long time. And not only that, she's the daughter of a king. We probably ought to give her a proper burial. Go out and get her and let's bury her. And they went outside. What did they find? Nothing but her hands, her feet, and her skull. The dogs had eaten everything else. And so the prophecy came true, what God had given. Look at it there real quick. Let's see, I need to go back to my thing here. Clear at the bottom. Yes, a second here. This is when they reported this to Jehu, verse 36. This is, we're talking now, 2 Kings 9, verse 36 and following. When they reported this to Jehu, he said, this is what the Lord said would happen. When he spoke through his servant Elijah, dogs will eat Jezebel's body in the territory of Jezreel. Her remains will be scattered there like dung, so that no one will be able to identify them. And so here's the story. If you want to follow Baal, you can start out as the daughter, the high priestess of Baal. You will end up as dog's dung. Is that the way you want to go? And that's the story of Ahab and Jezebel. And we can ask ourselves a lot of things about this story. I think we've asked ourselves quite a few things. I guess the thing I would leave you with is, why is a story like this included in the Bible? Why do we need to know about the lives of these awful people? Surely this is not one of those deeds that we should follow, some example of the Bible, deeds to be done and sins to be shunned. This would certainly have to come under the category of sins to be shunned. We don't want to be like them. Let's pray. Our kind and loving Father, we know from this story and from many others that when necessary, you can take control of this situation. You can show your power. But we know that even when you did that, it didn't make a huge difference. It wasn't long before the people were back just as bad as they had been before. God, we don't want you to have to do that. Speak to us with the still small voice as you did to Elijah. And soon he was ready to be translated. Help us not to be wowed by the power, but to be convinced by the truth, is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for coming.